BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello.
10, 9, ignition sequence start.
Now, watch this space. That's often how we end our reports on this programme, but today it is our subject.
Tower cleared.
It's been a long time since we were astonished at getting a man on the moon, but now we're asking, is there a place in space for visually impaired people? And is the fact that one effect of continuous zero gravity can be damaging to your eyes going to make that more or less likely? We're going to be talking about that in a moment with a NASA optometrist who's studying it. But first, I'm joined by Dr. Sherry Wells-Jensen, who's a professor of linguistics at Bowling Green State University in Ohio and is researching how to make outer space accessible to all of humanity, including us. Oh, and by the way, she is totally blind. So let me cut to the chase, Sherry. Is there a place for visually impaired people in space?
Well, my immediate answer is, of course. I mean, there's a place for us everywhere we want to be. A blind person could go up in a suborbital flight yesterday. There's nothing inaccessible about that. You get into the cabin, you experience some extreme acceleration upward, and then you float there for 3 or 4 minutes, and you come back down, boom. There's nothing that a blind person can't do. Sit in the seat, get out of the seat, get back in the seat. You do that in your living room every day, right? So if you want to just go up and float around for a little bit, that's all the fun you've ever imagined in the world. I've been on a zero-G parabolic flight, so I know a tiny bit about zero gravity. And it depends on what you want to do in space. Do we want to fly the ship? Do we want to use a computer while we're there? What is our job going to be in space? So it's really all about making the job accessible, right? Not so much the environment. Space is a terrible, dangerous, bad place for everybody. It wreaks havoc on your muscles. It wreaks havoc on your bones. It's bad for almost every body system you have because we were not evolved for that. We were evolved to be here in nice, happy, pleasant little Earth with lots of available air and sunshine and water and gravity to pull us down.
Can I just ask you, when you did those simulated flights where you were experiencing zero gravity, did it live up to your expectations?
I just cannot describe to you the gentleness of the floating. You're just floating. And you're not, floating is the wrong word, because if you're floating in a pool, for example, that's lovely, but you always know which way's up and you always know which way's down, right? You're oriented. But in microgravity, the whole idea of up and down is just sort of erased from your brain. And you know you have arms and you have legs, but your legs are not reliably down because there is no down. And it's so gentle. It's like being held ever so tenderly. And with the touch of your finger, you can fly across the cabin. It is so much fun.
So you're taking this seriously. Is NASA taking this idea of visually impaired people in space seriously?
That's a really good question. NASA is not saying, heck no. But they're not saying, how do we get you there the fastest way we can possibly get you there? Please come. You know, I think cautious optimism, emphasis on cautious, because they don't want anyone to get hurt. They want the mission to go well. Those are sort of the two goals. And so I would say that there is not an active research program per se.
Right. But are they being influenced by this discovery that space flight can cause eye problems?
And I obviously don't speak for NASA, but I think the approach is, oh my gosh, space is doing something bad to the human body. Let's try to make it stop. It might turn out that there isn't a way to fix it. And it might turn out that it's worse than we think it is. In which case, at least our expertise will be welcome, if not our actual selves.
Well, I've been talking about this to Professor Tyson Brunstetter. He's an optometrist who's been studying for NASA this unforeseen eye condition.
SANS stands for Spaceflight Associated Neuroocular Syndrome, which is why we call it SANS. But it is a unique condition to spaceflight that affects the eyes and brain of astronauts.
And without going into too much technical sort of jargon, what does it do? What is happening within the eyes?
So one of the end results that we diagnose frequently in our crew members are four main signs. The first is called optic disc edema, and this is a swelling of the neurons that transmit visual information from the eye back to the brain. With enough swelling over enough time, this can enlarge a person's blind spots. It can cause simply areas where you don't see. If it's severe enough for a long enough period of time, it can become a permanent loss of vision, which of course we want to avoid. But we've got also folds that appear in the retina, which is essentially the camera film that captures light, and it's what our brain uses to generate vision. So you can imagine if the film, the retina of the eye, is folded, at some point it can cause a distortion in a person's vision. Luckily, we've never diagnosed distorted vision due to these folds from SANS. A third main sign for SANS are shifts in refractive error. In other words, if you fly into space, you might find that the prescription of your glasses or contact lenses has shifted. And then finally, the fourth main sign of SANS is a physical flattening of the back of the eye. We don't know of any definite risks associated with this flattening, but of course, it is a little bit shocking when you see it on the imaging.
And how serious is this? I mean, how much has it been actually seen in astronauts, and have people actually experienced vision loss?
So ever since the beginning of human spaceflight, the eyes of astronauts have been examined before the flight and after the flight. Today, we monitor eyes pre-flight and post-flight, but also in flight. And we diagnose SANS in about 71% of all crew members who fly for long periods of time. A typical mission on board the ISS is about 6 months. So in about 71, 72% of those folks, we do diagnose SANS. We've detected a handful of folks with those enlarged blind spots. Of course, with those shifts in refractive error that require glasses and things of that nature, but luckily no permanent impairment. Although we have diagnosed SANS in a crew member as early as 10 days into a mission, it takes time for SANS to develop and worsen. And so most of our data is based on 6 month mission. We are concerned about what happens during a 1 year mission, what happens during a 2.5 or 3 year mission to Mars. And that's really where I lose sleep at night. It's thinking about how do we mitigate SANS for missions to Mars.
So what is it, Dr. Brunstetter, what is it about spaceflight that causes this?
We strongly believe that the primary driver for this, besides just simply being in space, is the fact that there's no gravity. And as you and I are sitting here talking, gravity is pulling fluids down towards our lower extremities, especially down towards our legs and our feet. When you go into space, as soon as you enter into what we call microgravity, zero Gs, the fluid wants to distribute uniformly. So if you watch a video of someone making a drop of water in space, it immediately forms into a sphere. And so the fluid in our body wants to do the same thing. It wants to become as much of a sphere as it can. What that really means is about 1 to 2 liters of fluid migrates from our lower extremities up towards our head. And it somehow causes these signs that we see as SANS, as well as the brain changes.
But obviously, as you've said, the concern about this is longer flights, which is what's going to happen, presumably, with space exploration. Is this not concerning astronauts? Because presumably they're aware of this risk.
They are. They're aware. NASA considers SANS to be we call it a red risk for Mars missions, meaning this is a condition that needs to be mitigated. It needs to be treatable by the time we go to Mars to ensure that our crew members are able to see and function and perform as they should when they touch down on the surface of Mars and then return. Even a slight loss in visual acuity could affect not only that person's safety and health, but also the overall mission. So there is quite a bit of seriousness associated with SANS. And so NASA, as well as its international partners, including ESA, our European Space Agency partner, we are doing our very best to try to investigate these risks, these conditions, and try to find proper treatments.
Professor Tyson Brunstetter, and listening to that with me is Dr. Sherry Wells Jensen. Sherry, I mean, what effect do you think that might have on the idea of visually impaired people going into space?
Well, the first thing that's going to happen is that our expertise will be needed. If they decide, okay, people are going to have X percent less terrific vision when they get to Mars, eventually someone's going to say, and maybe it's going to be one of us, right? Hey, guys, we know what to do with X percent less vision. We're good with that. We know how to help you. If they decide that they cannot treat this thing, then they're going to start thinking about what are the accommodations that they're going to need. Eventually, it's going to click for folks that if they've made those accommodations, they could send at least someone who has that amount of vision loss. Someone who is legally blind, who can, you know, maybe still read print or something
like that. Got a bit of sight. Got a bit of use.
Yeah, I think, I think I'm not next in line. I don't think you're next in line either. Sorry.
Will we have a real role to perform, or will we just be taken along for the inclusivity ride, you know, ticking the disability box?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know what? I think it's about the person who goes and what they insist on, right? I think for a long-term mission right now, you can't afford just to send someone because of how super cool you'll look for sending a blind person. We can't afford to do that. Space is a difficult environment. We don't have room for people that are just going to lollygag around and be pretty. We need people who get stuff done. You need a pilot, you need a doctor, right? You need these kind of roles, and whoever goes is going to have to fill one of those roles. But part of it depends on if we do something about that, right? Are we working to get our young people into STEM fields so that they can be ground crew for some of these flights? Because once you've got a bunch of disabled people and a bunch of blind people working as ground crew, then they're like, oh yeah, look at all these disabled people. They're space people. We should pick one of them to go. But as long as we are rare in the STEM fields, I think it will be harder for us to raise awareness enough so that we can go as something beyond window dressing.
Dr. Sherry Wells Jensen, thank you so much for joining us. Just one note before we go. A few weeks ago, we were discussing the potential merits of the Ray-Ban Meta glasses for visually impaired people. And it was mentioned in that programme that a brand offering similar products in the field, Orcam, had been discontinued. We need to offer some clarification to those who got in touch about this. Orcam no longer sells their products directly to customers in the UK. Instead, they've made the assistive technology provider Optelec their exclusive distributor to UK customers. So you can still buy Orcam products here, but through Optelec. If you currently own an Orcam product and you purchased it through them, then you can still go to them if you need assistance. But if you bought it through Optelec, you need to go to them. As always, we'd like your views and comments on anything you've heard in the programme. Do you fancy a few months on Mars? Let us know. Email in touch at bbc.co.uk or you can leave voice messages on 0161 836 1338. From me, Peter White, and producer Beth Hemmings, goodbye.